Folks, this is what democracy looks like. I am so excited to be with all of you here in Arcata tonight. I'm so thrilled that this came together on pretty short notice. I had a town hall last night in Trinity County. It was a big crowd by Trinity County standards. We had a wonderful discussion, about 160 engaged members of that community. And I had some other events in Trinity County that were going to happen tomorrow and today. They fell through, and so on very short notice, we had a chance to add a town hall here in Humboldt County. And the amazing thing is we were going to use the new Performing Arts Center here at Arcata High School. I was excited to see it. But within 24 hours, we had received way too many RSVPs to fit into the Performing Arts Center. So here we are with both bleachers down in the gymnasium and people sitting on the floor and lining the wall. They tell me there may be 1,200 people in this gym. So now, just to check, there's a rumor going around Washington that the crowds filling these town halls are all paid protesters. So how many of you have been paid by George Soros to be here? Okay. What's George paying these days, by the way? That's all right. We're very grateful to Arcata High School. I want to especially thank Jim Ritter from the Northern Humboldt School District for making this happen. When I heard that the school district was actually closed this week, my first thought was, wow, Betsy DeVos's plan for public education is ahead of schedule. But in fact, this was a pre-scheduled break, and it just happened to work out very well for our needs. I want to thank Access Humboldt for videotaping this program tonight. So why are we here? You know, ordinarily, when I have some time away from Washington in my district, a huge district, I've got six counties from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border, and I've got a lot of ground I like to cover. Ordinarily, I'd be out doing a lot of site visits of restoration projects and meeting with school kids and doing the things that a congressman does when he gets out and about the district during a time when he's not in Washington. But right now, it's very clear to me that the most important thing I can do is to engage directly with as many of my constituents as I can and have these town halls and other large meetings. And the reason for that is that people are concerned. There's something going on in this country, and you all are part of it. There's a reason why just about every public meeting I have has to be scheduled into a new venue, because there's so much interest. The community is so engaged. And frankly, a lot of people are afraid. They're worried about the political changes that we've seen in our national politics. But they're also not just going to surrender to fear and dismay. There's an enormous positive energy developing in this country, and I see some pink hats in this room. You know, that incredible, nonviolent, positive focus of the Women's March was so inspiring and such an important piece of what is happening in this country, and I think such an important part of how we're going to get through this together. Thank you for that. But look, as your congressman, here's how I see the current political climate. Those of you that have known me for a number of years know that I got into this work, you know, not to go and be a screamer and a fighter all the time. I like being a problem solver. I'm kind of a policy guy. I like rolling up my sleeves, and I'm not afraid to reach across the aisle. In fact, that's kind of one of the fun challenges of public policy and politics, to try to bring people together, come up with good ideas and just really get things done for people. That's why I ran for Congress back in 2012. And when I got elected, I definitely had this idea that I could go back to Washington and contribute to a better tone and better outcomes and better productivity. I still want that. I really do. And I want to continue trying to do my part to get things done and change the tone in Washington. But I'll tell you, I'm also very clear-eyed about what's going on right now in our country. And I know that my job right now is to fight. So we will talk about the various threats that I see facing our country. We'll do it tonight in a way that I hope and I'm confident will be very respectful and positive. I think it's important to acknowledge that not everybody here is of the same politics. And so I want to just speak to that briefly before we dive into your questions. We got a call at my district office from a woman who's a Trump supporter. And she asked, will it be safe for me to be there and to participate in this town hall? A very serious question since, look, our politics are pretty rough these days. I want her to know, I want all of you to know, whether you're Trump supporters or resistors or whatever, that I want to have a conversation with you. I really do. And I want it to be productive and respectful. And I know it will. And I know all of you want that too. So that's one of the principles I hope we all can agree on as we go forward tonight. In terms of the logistics of how we're going to do this, I've got two amazing district staffers here that I want to recognize because they're not only doing great work for me every day in Humboldt County, but they're in charge of the microphones tonight. So Lindsay over here and John right here. And what we're going to do is ask them to select about five people on each side of the gym to line up. And you will ask your questions or tell me what you want me to hear, if you want me to respond to something. And then we'll do that. If we can, we would like to limit that to about 1 minute because we got a lot of people here and I'd like to cover as much ground as possible. Sometimes it's hard for people to limit themselves to a 1 minute question. Sometimes it's hard to find the question lurking within long statements in situations like this. So we can all be part of keeping this on track. If someone needs a little bit of positive encouragement to wrap up their question, and they're going maybe beyond a minute or 2 minutes, and we want to get on and cover as much ground as possible, you can kind of quietly start applauding to give them that encouragement. And I'm sure that we're going to get through this together. I really want to try to accommodate anyone who has mobility issues. So if you have a wheelchair or a cane or need a little bit of extra help, raise your hand and we will find a way to get the microphone up to you. But make sure that you're connecting with Lindsay on this side and John on that side, and we'll try to get everybody into the mix. I think have I covered everything, folks? I think we're ready to roll here. So why don't I ask Lindsay and John, just raise your hands if you'd like to come to the microphone, and they'll pick a few people on each side and we'll get started. All right, welcome. Let's start right over here to my left. If you could just state your name and ask whatever you'd like.
My name is Judy Royer, and I wanted to...
A little louder, if you can.
I wanted to especially thank you for coming tonight, especially in light of your recent loss of your mom.
Thank you.
I really feel for you for that. And I just wanted to ask you, one of your colleagues in the House, Barbara Lee, has put forth a resolution 140, to require Steve Bannon to step down from the National Security Council.
Yeah.
So I really want to have you support that effort from her.
Well, I'm already... Thanks, Judy, for the question. The question is about whether Steve Bannon, who is not a national security expert, who is an alt-right, maybe, journalist, should be on the National Security Council. I strongly believe he should not be, and I was as horrified as many of you. And frankly, you know, some pretty credible Republicans on national security and foreign policy issue have criticized this as well. This guy has no place in the Situation Room. He's a political hack, and we need to make sure that the most sensitive national security deliberations are happening with the people that should be in the room. That probably should include the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It probably should include the Intelligence Committee. I mean, come on, this is common sense. And yet we have an administration who has reshuffled it to exclude the people that should be in the room and to include political hacks. And so, yeah, you can count on me to support that type of resolution and other requests to clean it up. Let's go over here.
Okay, my name is Sylvia DeRoy, and my question for you is, how do we get the Oversight Committee to do their job? Is there anybody in that committee who is particularly vulnerable who we should target? What can we do? And also, I'd like to add, thank you for being here. We're all grateful to you for doing this.
Thank you, Sylvia. Appreciate it. So that is a great and timely question, and it's a source of great frustration for me as a member of Congress. You know, one of the powerful things that Congress can do is oversight. That's what it's supposed to do, actually, as an independent branch of government. And you can think of some amazing successes of congressional oversight. I personally think of people like Henry Waxman holding hearings where he brought in the tobacco industry and held them to account for the studies that they knew showed that tobacco caused cancer, and yet they concealed it and they marketed to young people. That's the kind of powerful thing that congressional oversight can do, and it changed things. It changed the world. Congressional oversight, of course, ultimately brought down Richard Nixon after Watergate. It took 2 years, by the way, after the Watergate break-in to the time of the actual impeachment, and that was at a time when Democrats controlled those committees. So it does take time for this oversight process to actually build the facts and get the outcome, but it's a very powerful thing, and it's not happening right now. This is a group of folks in the House. Jason Chaffetz from Utah is the chair of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. And, yeah, he's had some interesting town halls lately, hasn't he? He seems infinitely interested in Benghazi, and convened any number of hearings and scorched earth subpoenas, and gosh, they took a huge interest in the IRS, and they tried to impeach the IRS commissioner on a specious argument. They are fascinated by email scandals, but they're unwilling to look at all into these Russia connections between the Trump administration and the Trump campaign, even in the face of these huge red flags waving with General Flynn and with our intelligence community confirming, in their words, that there were constant contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence officials at the exact same time Russia was interfering in our election to try to help Donald Trump. Now, maybe there's a benign explanation for that. Can any of you think of some benign explanation for why these high-level campaign advisors of Team Trump would be meeting with intelligence officials from Russia who were actively trying to undermine our election? I can't think of it, but maybe serious oversight would reveal that benign explanation. And we'll keep pushing on Jason Chaffetz to do the right thing. I'm not saying it would have changed the election, but we need the facts and we need the answers. The other committee that really should be in the game on this is the House Intelligence Committee. And that's where a Californian is the chair. It's a gentleman named Devin Nunes. And he has said that he's willing, in fact, he's real angry. He's hopping mad about this situation. He's going to investigate the leaks that embarrassed General Flynn and caused this great public servant to have to leave office. He's very mad about the leaks, but he has no interest in investigating the actual misconduct. So we are going to have to make it clear to them and others that that's just not going to fly. That's not doing a service to congressional oversight and to the American people. You can count on me to keep pushing on it. Okay?
Hi, I'm Patty Rose, and I'm going to piggyback off of Sylvia's question, only a little more poignant. What are the Democrats doing about a foreign government interfering with our elections, about Comey, and about a president who won't divest himself when everybody else is supposed to? Is he special?
Yeah. Is he special? Let's say. All right. Well, I can tell you a few things that are actively underway, and you may be familiar already with some of this. Over in the Senate, it's a much more bipartisan undertaking, I'm happy to say. You've got senators as recently as Susan Collins, just within the last 24 hours, saying that she's willing to put administration officials under oath and actually take testimony and do her job. So, I frankly have been really heartened when I hear Republican senators like Corker and McCain and others willing to hold the Trump administration to a high standard and to bring accountability to them. That's what Congress should do. I'm not hearing the same thing in the House of Representatives, unfortunately. So I'll just try to keep pushing as much as I can. And was there another part of your question that I missed, or did I answer it?
Foreign government interfering in
sure.
our elections?
So there is a commitment to investigate that in both houses through the intelligence committees. There will be an investigation, and we know that the FBI and the intelligence community is also actively looking at this. Here's the problem with that. If that's the only place where these investigations take place, then the information that comes forward could remain classified, and we may never know. The public may never know the full extent of what actually happened. That's why I have joined with a whole bunch of colleagues, so far only Democrats, but we're actually still hoping we can get some Republicans on this, to demand an independent commission to do this investigation. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll work on that. Go over here.
My name's Peggy Dickinson. My question is, California typically gets about $300 million in federal funding each year. Yeah. And with the passage of the California Values Act, which is now in the Appropriations Committee, I'm concerned about how we can oppose Trump or prevent Trump from carrying out his plan to stop federal funding to any sanctuary cities or entities. And it concerns me very seriously
yeah.
because of all of social welfare help that California gets.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is true. California gets a lot of federal money. We also donate a lot of money to the federal treasury. We're a net donor state. So a couple of things about that question. First, as much as you occasionally hear Donald Trump tweet about maybe punishing California or hint that he's going to try to withhold funds, he's got an executive order out there that kind of, on the one hand, suggests that we should look at withholding grant funds from sanctuary-type states and governments, but on the other hand, caveats that with a whole bunch of stuff, you know, consistent with existing law, et cetera. Well, he can't do it, is the bottom line. The Constitution prohibits him from doing it. The 10th Amendment, there's actually a case law out there. It's called commandeering when the federal government tries to do that. So we will fight mightily if there is any attempt by this administration to play politics with grant funding or social services or emergency response, anything like that. And just know that the state of California is geared up for this fight as well. They've hired a pretty good lawyer for this is a guy named Eric Holder, so you may have heard of him. Yeah. So I think we're going to be okay. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having this town hall. It's my first one I've ever been to.
How many other people are at their first town hall? Wow. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, my name is Shauna. I'm a political science major, student of politics, student of the world. I'm always talking about the issues, doing what I can do to help impact change, for real. What are you doing as our congressman to repair what I see as a huge, I don't know, team building, a collaboration problem within the Democratic Party? Mm-hmm. Because Republicans are really good at standing up for each other. Republicans are really good at doing things for each other. And, like, even though this guy might not agree with this guy, he's going to do what's best for the Republican Party. Yeah. And I feel like there's a really big division between Democrats, liberal, and, you know, closer to the center, Democrats, right? Like, there's just such a problem where we can't stand with each other on a lot of issues, I feel like. Just, like, outside looking in, like, what are you doing and what can we do to unite, like, our party and also with the Green Party, you know, and the Independent Party even, too? Mm-hmm. What can we do to unite these forces? Because Republicans seem very indivisible, but Democrats seem very divisible.
Great. Well, Shauna, thanks. Thanks for that great question. And I think it is true from a political science standpoint that the Democratic Party is a bigger tent, which leads to some challenges. We've got an awful lot of constituencies and coalitions that have their own priorities. But I will say this. I know from the outside sometimes, especially from the Democratic lens, it looks like the Republicans are just so unified and disciplined. And it looks like Democrats are just a mess. And it especially looks like that after this election, because things didn't go our way. I promise you that had 80,000 votes been rearranged between three states, they would look like that, and we would look like we were this monolith that was marching forward. So I guess my premise is I believe beneath the surface there is far more unity in the Democratic Party right now than it might appear from the outside. I think our priorities are in pretty good shape. I think we all kind of care about the same stuff, and I think we're focused on the same threats right now. And I think, on the other side, Republicans look pretty unified, but they're not. They're really not. There are enormous fault lines beneath the surface, and those are going to start to show as we go forward. One of the reasons, quite frankly, that it looks like Trump and especially House Republicans are just lockstep right now is they want to get stuff from this guy. Privately, they'll tell you that they're horrified by a lot of the things that he's doing. They're embarrassed by a lot of the things he's doing. They're not sure he's going to finish out his term. Things are so crazy in this administration. But what they want is they want to get a Supreme Court justice confirmed that meets their ideological litmus test. They want to try to get tax reform. They say they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but, you know, good luck actually doing that. And then once they feel like they've checked off a few things that they've gotten, I will predict they're going to turn on this guy pretty quickly because the cracks are below the surface in a big way. It was interesting. I read today a quote from former Speaker John Boehner, who is sort of free to speak very candidly now. And he was asked about these Republican promises to repeal and replace Obamacare. And he said he laughed when he heard that and that there's no way that that's going to happen. And it's certainly not going to happen anytime soon. He predicted that the Affordable Care Act will remain in place and will simply have some technical changes made to it. So, you know, I guess a long-winded answer to your question, but I guess what I'm saying is for those of you that are Democrats or on the left side of the spectrum, however you identify, I would take some heart in the unity that I see everywhere I go. It's only growing. It's positive. It's focused. And I think it's heading in a very hopeful direction. Yeah.
My name is Debbie. My question concerns the corporations that seem to be backing a lot of the political changes and so forth. Mm-hmm. What can we as individuals do about that? The other question is, what can you do? A lot of these are either blatantly monopolies or pretty close to it. And we at least used to have a lot of laws about breaking up monopolies. So can you institute anything concerning that to disrupt a lot of these corporations that are basically running the country?
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a lot of the consolidations we're seeing in certain industries, mergers and concentration of power, the banks, things like that. Is that, yeah. Well, this is one of those cases where it's important for everyone to understand that elections really do have consequences. Because as unsatisfactory as perhaps the Obama administration might have been on some of these things, and by the way, they did reject some mergers, and they did do some things in this area, you are now looking at an administration that is probably going to want to see much more consolidation and thinks that that's a good thing. So we're going to have to push back. We'll push back politically. I will try to stand up for consumers and do what I can. All of you, as you get involved as citizens and participate in these movements, I think should continue to speak out and raise your voices. That does make a difference. But we're going to have to win an election in 2018, and we're going to have to take the House back. And in the meantime, on this issue and on so many other issues that reflect core values and priorities, the courts are really an important place. So those organizations that have lawyers that are ready to go to court to challenge mergers or to challenge corrupt activities where power is concentrated in corporate America and you don't have good corporate citizenship, those organizations probably deserve your support, because we're going to be counting on them for the next couple years in a big way.
Hello.
Hi.
I want to preface this by saying I actually do support you. However, the Democrats lost the presidency, the House, the Senate, 2/3 of the governorships, and most of the state legislatures. What are you going to do to repair the Democratic Party? Will you now support people instead of corporations and the establishment? Will you support working people? And in your campaign, will you only accept small donations? So, yes, I support somebody who's working the good fight, but I really want to know what you're going to do.
You bet. So thanks for the question. Look, I think as in terms of the direction of the Democratic Party, if we're looking fairly at this last election, we see that we lost faith with some working class folks, especially in the heartland, right? There's some successes. California went great. Nevada was great. We had a few other really good successes, but that Rust Belt area, which frankly includes a lot of voters who were never with Democrats on social issues, you know, these are folks that on guns and religion and a bunch of other things often had very different sensibilities, but they were with Democrats on the economy, always. And in many cases, they would hold their nose on guns and social values and know that Democrats had their back on jobs and the economy. And so one of the takeaways, I believe, is that Democrats have to reconnect with those people and let them know we hear them and that we actually have better answers for them. Now, we just saw a guy who was willing to run for president. I'm sorry to use a provocative term, but I think as a demagogue, by promising things that he knows he can't deliver, by going into Appalachia and promising that there's going to be this great renaissance of the coal industry, that's not going to happen. Even Donald Trump and his fossil fuel friends are not going to revive the coal industry. By going into parts of the Midwest that have lost a lot of the industrial workforce to globalization and saying he's going to bring it all back. You know, we should try. We got to do a lot to try to bring those jobs back and bring manufacturing back, but he didn't talk at all about automation and robotics and other dynamics that are contributing to this problem. So, you know, I think Democrats have an opportunity to reach out to those and other people and have an honest conversation and reconnect with them to let them know that we do hear them, we do care about them, and we do have policies that speak to their needs. The power of corporations and other things that are top concerns of yours and, frankly, mine, these are things that we have to address too, and it is going to have to include overturning Citizens United. So we have no shortage of work to do. We hope that this administration gets no more than one Supreme Court justice, because Citizens United was a 5-4 decision. It's just hard not to be terribly frustrated and dismayed that we lost the opportunity to shape the Supreme Court for the next generation. We're going to have to find a way to overcome that. So, look, we've got a lot of work together to do. I think our values, though, are common values. We all want the same thing, and this is a time to come together and focus on the key 2018 elections, which will be the first chance to start turning this thing around. Okay?
Hi, my name is Dara Carver-Dodgen, and I wanted to ask, how do you intend to address federal legislation trying to dismantle medical marijuana laws? My brother has a rare genetic disease and is kept alive because of medical marijuana. How do you tell parents that their children will be put in danger?
Well, we're not going to let them take us backward on medical marijuana, first of all. But this is... It's a valid concern, and I hear you loud and clear. As much as I think we need to celebrate the progress that we've made here in California and in a majority of states now, by the way, in this country that have legalized medical cannabis at least, and in a growing number that have allowed adults to make the choice about whether they want to use cannabis, we have a new attorney general who just has a terrible record on this stuff. He has said awful things about marijuana, and he has refused really during his confirmation hearing to be very clear with us and transparent with us about what he's going to do. So we know that under the Obama administration, it was basically a policy of deference. You know, we have this federal law that says marijuana is always just like heroin. It's always illegal. It can never be used for any reason. There was only one facility down in the Deep South that was even allowed to do research on marijuana under federal law at one point. So we had a policy from the prior attorney general that if states acknowledged medical cannabis, as long as they complied with certain rules, the federal government would not prosecute under that federal law. It's called the Cole Memo, and that allowed folks who wanted to get into the medical cannabis business to do it with some degree of confidence that they weren't going to be raided and thrown in jail. I still think that deference is likely to continue. Donald Trump, as a candidate, said this was a states' rights issue. Jeff Sessions loves to talk about states' rights when it comes to abortion and other issues. So, you know, we'll find out how he reconciles his fierce opposition to marijuana with a stated support for states' rights. But look, the truth is, I don't think there's going to be legislation. You referenced legislation. I don't think a bill like that could pass either house of Congress. We've got a growing coalition in both houses of Congress that certainly supports medical cannabis, and I think increasingly comes from states that have accepted adult use and will support legalization ultimately. Yeah. Go over here. How are you?
Good evening. Two questions.
Okay.
An easy one and then a hard one.
Okay.
Number one, I'm a fan of the Colbert Show. What is the tallest tree in the world?
The tallest tree?
What kind of tree is the tallest tree in the world?
Well, it's the redwood tree.
Thank you.
Yeah. However, but he asked me the oldest tree, and he tripped me up because he claims it's not the redwood tree, right?
So, well, the oldest, as far as we know, is what?
He claims the bristlecone.
The bristlecone is the oldest,
yeah.
Though there's other older ones.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. We'll talk separately about this, yeah.
Because yeah. There's that one in Sweden. Anyway, and now the hardball. These last two presidential elections were marred by election fraud. In 2012, the Republicans against Ron Paul, and this year, by some of the old Democrats, against Bernie Sanders. To the point that the DNC head resigned, and this Saturday we'll be picking a new one. My question is, Are you going to get on board with the rest of us who want these bums thrown out who did this, or are you going to stick the line that you've been on?
All right. All right, hey. I appreciate the question. So let's dive into that subject. There is a perception out there among many of Bernie's supporters that some really rotten things happened emanating out of the DNC. They feel like the deck was stacked. So look, if you're asking, am I for accountability for anybody that was revealed to have, like whoever those staffers were that were talking about embarrassing Bernie about his religion in those two states, totally unacceptable. They were fired. They should have been fired. There should be accountability for anybody that had any part in that. That's highly unprofessional. You don't want that anywhere. All right? In terms of Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she resigned. Okay? She's gone. Yeah. Okay. Look, I'm going to be honest with you guys. Okay? We're going to have an honest, grown-up conversation here about this. Most people I talk to about this cannot even tell me what the DNC does. All right? And yet it has become this massive Death Star, you know, that is the source of all evil and stealing elections and all this other stuff. I feel like some context is required in this conversation. I'm not justifying any of the bad, embarrassing stuff that was revealed. But I will tell you that if the Russians had every single email from everybody in the Sanders campaign, there might have been some embarrassing stuff. Okay? The Russians instead got into the DNC system, and let's forget the leak, forget all that other, let's hold them accountable. Let's have a new DNC, and gee, we're going to have a new election coming up in the days ahead.
Saturday.
I am supporting Keith Ellison to be the chair of the DNC. All right. Touchdown, 49ers? Okay. And I support Keith because I know him and I love him and I think his values are great. But I also think with him at the helm, it would be a rebuilding of confidence in the committee. But I guess my main message to all of you is not to confuse the DNC with this Death Star that is the Democratic Party, because it's just really not. It's this organization that raises money for the presidential nominee, that does have a role in convening the convention and setting the debates and all that. But the Democratic Party is so much bigger than the DNC. It's all of the national and even state and other level elected officials. It's all the people in the state central committees and the local central committees. And frankly, all of you have a role to play in deciding what it means to be a Democrat. It's not just whoever happens to win that election in the days ahead to be chair. Okay? All right. Thanks.
Right. Can I make a point of order, too?
Yeah.
We have some folks that have joined the line, which if we could maybe try to get through them, and then we'll pick a new group of folks. I want to make sure that we get to people who can't stand in line for the entire time.
Right. We don't want people standing forever. So why don't we'll get through people who are standing right now, and then we'll have Lindsay and John go out and grab a new group, okay?
Dave Startery, third-generation veteran.
Great, thanks for your service, Dave.
Yeah, thank you. What are you doing to repair U.S. 101 at the Last Chance Grade just this side of Crescent City?
Thank you. That's a big, big deal, and I appreciate the question very much. So what I've been doing for the last going on 2 years is what I think is the most hopeful way to get that project designed, approved, and funded before a catastrophe happens, and that is to bring all the key stakeholders together. And I really have a wonderful staff that has pulled together a working group, a stakeholder group, that I think does embody that full spectrum of stakeholders. We have the tribes, the private timberland owners. We have the state and national parks. We have the local government leaders. We have Caltrans. Everybody is at the table. And we have been methodically going through the alternate routes to try to select one that, you know, probably not everybody will be thrilled with, because there's no easy route. You're talking about old growth redwoods and sensitive habitat and You know, everyone, EPIC is at the table and the environmental community. But if we can all agree on a route that we could at least live with and then join together and go to the state and federal government to get this thing funded, that's our best chance. And so that's what I've done. And we're very close now. We have had a facilitator. We've had consultants developing these alternate routes, running the numbers on them. I think we're close, and I'm hoping to hold that group together, get it over the finish line, and then go get some money and get this thing done. We don't want to build it after the crisis happens. We want to build it before. Yeah. Okay? All right.
Hi, my name is Honore, and I've been saddened and sickened over the past week, more and more each day, as I've watched the massive immigrant deportation policy start to play out. Watching families being torn apart and their children being put into foster care, spending $25 billion on this inhumane, mean-spirited, short-sighted policy. Is there anything that Congress is going to do to stop it?
Yeah, I hope so. I appreciate your question, and I want you to know a couple things. Did you have more? Did you have more, or do you want me to go ahead and answer?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks for the question. This is a big, big deal for our country, and it's a big deal for a lot of communities that I care about in my congressional district. And so I have been going around and meeting with immigrant advocates, local leaders, folks from the faith community, law enforcement, to try to figure out how we're going to restore confidence. What we can't have is a community that lives in fear. We also can't have a government that is doing things that actually tear families apart and make communities fearful. So a couple of things. The first is we need to kind of sort out the false alarms from the actual facts. And I'm hearing this a lot from the immigrant community. There are so many rumors going around out there about raids and activities on the ground, people claiming that ICE agents are showing up at schools and doing sweeps. And one thing my office can do is we can call ICE and absolutely get answers. Was there a raid? Was there a sweep? They will tell us. So far, we're not seeing any of that stuff. That doesn't mean that we stop being vigilant, but we're not seeing any new enforcement activity that wasn't consistent with what was happening under the prior administration. However, these executive orders are strongly hinting at changes. The new guidance that came out this week that talks about instead of just folks with serious crimes, even folks that may have only been charged with a crime and maybe only a trivial crime, that could trigger some kind of deportation activity. That's deeply, deeply troubling. I will challenge and fight that in every possible way I can. Okay? Certainly, if we get any sign that dreamers are getting caught up in any of this, we are going to fight that in every way we can. And you asked, is Congress going to get involved to stop it? And I think the answer is yes. I actually think, despite what it looks like right now, I think there's bipartisan support to protect the dreamers in the United States Congress. So we will push back, I hope, as necessary if that begins to unfold. The other thing I'm trying to do is reach out to law enforcement and local governments throughout my district because they can provide some assurance to the community that, our local cops are not doing traffic stops where they check immigration status, right? We need everybody to understand that. They're not going into schools. They're not going to hospitals so that immigrants fear for taking their kids to hospitals to get medical care. They need to know they can do that without somehow Medicaid or other authorities reporting them to ICE. We need to get them the assurances. And then if, God forbid, the Trump administration actually does start crossing those red lines, we will take them to court. The state of California will take them to court. We will fight them, and I think we'll prevail under the Constitution. Okay?
My name is Daniel Duncan. I just wanted to say, before I give you a couple topics to comment on, the great Uruguayan poet Eduardo Galeano said, "Fear is an unreliable counselor." It's something that we all, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on, we need to remember that.
That's great.
The first point that I want to make is that the DAPL and the Keystone XL pipeline will contribute no petroleum products to the American reserves. They will all go into an international pool.
Yes.
And right. we will have to beg for our gas tanks. Okay? That's one. Two, I consider myself a progressive, if you will. I've been a first voter for Adlai Stevenson back in 1952. I was very dismayed that when Senator Baucus from Montana was holding hearings about health care, that any discussion of single payer was nixed. And the problem is that what we have now is a system whereby the government enforces its citizens to purchase health insurance from private industry. This is called fascism. Very plain and simple. It is fascism. When the corporations run the government, that's called fascism. It happened in Italy. It happened in Germany. It's not total here. Well, I'm having a Rick Perry moment.
No, you're
forgotten
not.
My theory.
You're doing so much better than Rick Perry. It's unbelievable. Yeah. All right, you want me to speak about single-payer health care, right? Which I'm happy to do.
And the biggie. And the biggie, I would say.
Okay.
And that is on everybody's mind every 4 years, and that is the Electoral College.
The Electoral College. Okay. Yeah. All right. Can we take those in reverse order? Let's start with the Electoral College. Look, this is one of these anachronisms that's very hard to explain to someone that doesn't live in the United States of America. It's that part of our civics education where you begin to learn that we're not an actual democracy, we're a democratic republic, and that our checks and balances and limits on power extend into federalism and into all of these different things. Why do small rural states get two U.S. senators and big old California gets two U.S. senators? The Electoral College is sort of in that category. I think it has outlived its usefulness, and I am supporting reforms to change it. So if you want your congressman to be on record and co-sponsoring legislation to, you know, get rid of the Electoral College, check that box. It's happening. But I'm also going to be honest with you. It's not going to happen anytime soon. It's just not, okay? And what I don't want to see is everybody put all their energy into Electoral College reform when we got less than 2 years to the 2018 midterm elections, and I would love to see that energy go into something more actionable. So, right? But I'm with you, and there may come a time. There may come a time where all of the three-quarters of the states which would be necessary to sign off on this to amend the Constitution and change the Electoral College, where suddenly somehow small states are willing to go along with getting rid of the Electoral College. It's against their own interests to do it, but maybe they'll just do the right thing. Right now, I don't think they're gonna, and you know, so I'll keep supporting it. We'll hope that the politics change. And in the meantime, the rules are the rules. We got to win the Electoral College. All right, got to get to 270. We should have got to it the last time. I think we should just plan on getting 270 in the next round and keep working on that front. Single-payer health care is maybe a little more hopeful. All right? And I do support. Each year I've been in Congress, I have co-sponsored John Conyers' Medicare for All legislation. And Going way back to my time in Sacramento with your former assembly member, Patty Berg, who I see right there. We worked together on single-payer legislation for the state of California. We actually passed it one year, got it to the governor's desk, and it was vetoed. But here's the thing. I think as we continue to flounder around this healthcare challenge and talk about different reforms and tinker with this private insurance model that you have likened to fascism, I'm not going to go quite that far, all right? But I don't like it any more than you do. I think inevitably the merits of just letting everybody participate in Medicare are going to come out by default. It just makes so much sense. And one way I think perhaps we can get there is to start by opening up Medicare to people before age 65, maybe age 55. They can start buying in earlier. It makes a lot of sense to do that. First of all, it would be a quality, affordable health insurance product that would probably be better than what they could get out there on the market anyway. But second, it's bringing younger, healthier people into the pool, into the risk pool for Medicare, and it would actually save money for Medicare. We do need to drive down the cost curve to stabilize Medicare for the long haul. One of the best ways to do it is to get more younger, healthier people into the pool. So let's keep working together. I'm pretty confident that we're going to get there eventually on national health insurance. But we're not going to get there by going backward. Let me just conclude my answer to your question by saying all of these Republican proposals to repeal and replace Obamacare are actually taking us back to what we had before 2010. And, you know, I had a woman at my Trinity town hall last night who I disagreed with on this subject. She was a Republican, and she said, "I hate the fact that the Affordable Care Act has ruined what used to be the best health care system in the world." And I kind of challenged her for, you know, give me some specifics. What are you talking about there? And the only thing she could come up with was all of the bureaucracy and red tape and stuff like that. Well, that was all there before. Talk to any doctor's office about the challenges they had of getting paid from all the different insurance companies. Talk to consumers. You want to talk about bureaucracy? How about somebody that gets sick and finds out that their insurer will no longer cover them because they've hit an annual cap or a lifetime cap? You want a bureaucracy? How about somebody who loses their job, falls on hard times, gets sick, and literally cannot get insurance coverage? And the only thing that they're told they can do is get in line for one of these high-cost pools that we used to have. Now, the Republicans are trying to take us full circle right back to that. They're saying the way we're going to cover pre-existing conditions is we'll create high-cost pools. As if this is a new idea, right, that some think tank has thought up. It's not. This is going back to what we had in many states before 2010. They did not work. They were enormously expensive. People had to wait in line to get accepted, and often they couldn't get the treatment they needed in time to save their lives. So it was kind of amazing when this conversation happened last night in Weaverville. The next gentleman that came up wasn't going to talk about health care, but he felt so strongly he had to share his story of how the Affordable Care Act saved his life. He had a heart attack on his job. And after he had open heart surgery and was going to be unable to work for a long period of time, his employer fired him. He was let go. And so he had the choice of purchasing COBRA coverage so that he could get the care he needed to stay alive. COBRA coverage is wildly expensive, but he was out of work and he couldn't do it. And so he literally had to go 2 years without seeing a doctor with a very serious heart condition. And thankfully, the Affordable Care Act came along and passed and gave him a chance to get insured. And he believes his life was saved. So, you know, we hear stories like that all over this country. The Affordable Care Act is not perfect. I didn't write it. I wasn't even in Congress to vote on it when it passed. And I'll be the first to say it needs some work in many areas. But we cannot go backward. Let's keep going forward. We can work on improving the Affordable Care Act, as John Boehner tells us we probably will, and we can keep moving forward incrementally towards single payer. Thanks for your question. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. This gentleman also asked about the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thank you for reminding me. I certainly wasn't avoiding that subject because I've been fighting as hard as I can in Congress with a handful of other colleagues that care deeply about this to try to stop it. We came together, about 30 of us, and had urged the Obama administration to withdraw that easement under the Missouri River, which was going to enable it to go forward last winter. And the Obama administration did the right thing, and I think many of us were encouraged when they denied the easement. They promised that there would be a full environmental impact process that would include respectful, appropriate consultation with the tribal community. That's what was missing in that project. And how discouraging to see one of the first acts, literally one of the first acts of the Trump administration, being an executive order that turned things around and went the other way. So right now, we're going to have to challenge that action in court. That's the best that we can do. I hope that the attorneys that are representing the Standing Rock Sioux and the other groups in that coalition can pull off a miracle and stop the project. But to your earlier point, you're exactly right. This project adds nothing to our strategic oil reserves. It's going to go down to refineries in various places that export this oil to the world market. Something really unfortunate happened last year as part of the government funding bill. We have, for 40 years, had a prohibition on exporting crude oil in this country. And, you know, it's a public policy that was meant to promote energy independence, to try to keep our crude oil here in this country and to not depend as much on volatile places where we import oil from. That was lifted a few months ago as part of the government funding bill. And so, yeah, there's a huge, there's a lot of money to be made on exporting oil because oil is more expensive on the world market than it is in the domestic market. So if you are able to extract oil in this country, the minute you can get it down to the refineries in Houston and get it on a boat and enter it into the international stream of commerce, you're going to make a significant amount more money on that oil than you would if you were actually serving people here in the United States. And you're exactly right on that point, so thank you. Yeah. I hear you. Thank you, sir. Let's go right over here.
Is it on? Okay, it's working. John Summers, moved to California a number of years ago. I'm happy to be one of your constituents.
Thank you.
I've voted for you a number of times.
Appreciate it. You get extra credit for that.
But, you know, that being said, I think, what is it, the Congress approval rating is somewhere in the high teens, low 20s.
Yeah.
A lot of folks are upset, and it seems to be the same people that keep getting reelected and reelected. And I think of a time where the voters pick the representatives, and their representatives don't pick their voters.
Right.
And I'd like to see an end to gerrymandering.
Me too. Hear, hear. Yeah. Is that your question?
I'd like your support for that.
Okay, John, thank you for that question. So we desperately need independent redistricting in this country. For the very reason that John said, you know, California once again is leading on this issue. We put in place this bold new reform of an independent redistricting commission. And it's an interesting process because politicians no longer have any say in how this works, and it makes them very nervous. I remember when I was getting ready to run for Congress in 2012, the Democratic establishment, people I now count as colleagues, Nancy Pelosi and others, were working overtime to try to get rid of this independent commission and bring back the power of redistricting because they wanted to draw the lines. They wanted to draw safe seats for people in their party, so they didn't have to worry about challenges and that they had a lot of certainty. I really wanted this commission to draw the lines because I wanted to have a cohesive district that made some sense and wasn't gerrymandered into craziness. And I'm so glad that this commission followed the rules that the voters of California laid out for them. You got to try to keep counties intact. You got to keep communities of interest intact. And what they came up with in my case was a coastal community of interest that is the Golden Gate Bridge to the Oregon border. It's such a wonderful district, and it just sort of makes sense. Far more sense, I think, than taking Humboldt County and going over the hill into Siskiyou and Modoc County, where, you know, those communities are not as connected as the 101 corridor. So I think it kind of worked. It was rational. It was logical. And we know that when politicians get into smoke-filled rooms, you see exactly what you said, politicians picking their constituents instead of the other way around. So I will fight to try to extend this model to other states. And here's the good news. People across party lines really like this idea. So they get intuitively what you were saying, that there's something rotten when politicians draw their own districts. If we can have independent redistricting in places like Texas and Florida and other states, you are going to see them turn blue so quick that it'll make your head spin. So let's get out there and do it. Thank you.
So we've had a number of comments about the line on this side, so I stopped the line where we made the last break. So I'm going to have John on that side. If you could raise your hands, and John will pick five more on that side, and hopefully we'll even it up. If we can get through all these, then we'll pick a new group of folks.
All right. Good. So we'll just stay over. We'll stay over here for now until John. Yeah.
And I'm going to ask people to keep their questions really brief so we can get through as many as possible.
Okay. Brief question. My name's Andrew, and I was very dismayed at the picks that Donald Trump is choosing for his cabinet, especially the one for the EPA. And
I wonder if
you could speak to that process and why these people are getting selected.
Thanks for the question, Andrew. Look, the why they're getting selected, there is no mystery here. What you see is what you get. Donald Trump just wants to hand the keys of government over to the fossil fuel industry, as far as I can tell. And he is, I guess what's been a little surprising is after he won the election, you know, what most people do in a very close, contentious election is they try to bring people together. They try to build bridges. And so part of me was sort of half expecting Donald Trump to not just continue in the wild extreme of, you know, putting the coal and oil and gas and other folks in charge of everything. I expected him to bring some Democrats into his cabinet, to moderate on some of these environmental issues, to kind of wake up and smell the coffee on climate change and some other things. And he just hasn't. He has doubled down on a very extreme anti-environment view to the point where we now have our Secretary of State is on loan from Exxon, right? And Scott Pruitt, the one you mentioned, is now confirmed as the director of the Environmental Protection Agency. He's a guy that has done nothing but sue and undermine and oppose this agency and has made it clear that he wants to dramatically weaken and gut the EPA. Look, there are parts of this country where the EPA is vilified and scapegoated. I think in Humboldt County, you know better, right? You know that it is a watchdog agency and a critical safeguard for clean water and clean air in our environment. And there's no better example than what happened at the Samoa pulp mill about 3 years ago. And that was a situation where a deadbeat owner had left behind millions of gallons of really toxic pulping liquors in tanks that were starting to fail. They were starting to fail in a fragile little spit of land between the Pacific Ocean and Humboldt Bay. And if something like that had actually failed catastrophically, our regional director of EPA told me it would have been one of the worst environmental catastrophes in the country that we've ever seen. And worst of all, it happened. Remember the government shutdown? I think it was October of 2013. It happened right during the government shutdown. So who came to the rescue? Who prevented that catastrophe and protected all of you? It was the EPA, despite being shut down. The EPA came through with emergency teams. They got that toxic stuff out of those tanks and offloaded. Not only did we were we spared from a catastrophe, but that site is now, you know, well on its way to being cleaned up and repurposed for some really hopeful and wonderful things. So I have no problem fighting for this EPA. We're going to have to fight for it in the years ahead. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Mary Flowers. I've been a public school teacher all my life.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
And I work now with English learners. Mm-hmm. I just learned about House Bill 610. That is what I understand to be the first step in defunding the public education institution as we know it. And I want to know where you stand with this, and I want to know what we okay. can do.
I don't always, thank you for the question. Thank you for being an educator. And thank you for being here tonight. I don't always know the numbers of bills as they get introduced. Sometimes the action alerts go out to people faster than they go to members of Congress. Is that a voucherization program or something like that? I'm seeing some nodding heads. So I'm not surprised that you would see that. Yeah. School nutrition and yeah. Right. Okay. It sounds like a nightmare piece of legislation. You certainly don't have to worry about me voting on it. I'll oppose it in every way that I can. But look, I think we're going to have to be vigilant out there on public education. We don't want this wonderful success of public education in America to be eroded through this misnomer of choice, right, which is what the Betsy DeVos's and a lot of our Republican friends are throwing around as the solution. Sometimes the solution is actually providing adequate funding and support so that teachers are paid well, right? Instead of always creating this race to the bottom, but, you know, there's also a maybe more sinister agenda behind it, which has always been about getting more religion into education and kind of crossing that bridge between church and state. And ultimately, the holy grail for some of these folks is to provide vouchers that let folks go to religious schools on the taxpayer's dime. So for all of these reasons, I'm going to fight against all that. I think the American people are with us on this. If necessary, I think the Supreme Court would be with us on this. And I still think, even now, that a majority of Congress will stop a wrongheaded bill like that before it gets too far. We'll see. I'll certainly try my best. Yeah. Thank you. All right.
Hello, sir. I am a student of HSU. I am a second-year political science major who is interested in public policy. My question to you, sir, is can a bill or California ballot initiative be introduced to assert states' rights to deny jurisdiction of ICE in such a way that state and local law enforcement agencies, as well as civilian organizations and individuals, be prohibited to cooperate with or be deputized by the Department of Homeland Security regarding the immigrant residents of the states?
Okay. So thank you for the question. This goes to the issue of whether in California we can prevent our local and state enforcement authorities from becoming immigration cops, basically. There's nothing, it's important to understand, there's nothing in federal law right now that requires them to become immigration cops or to cooperate with immigration authorities in any way. Right? And I think the good news is that most of the sheriffs and police departments in my district have no interest in doing that. They understand that if they are perceived in their community as arms of ICE, nobody's going to trust them. Nobody's going to report crimes in their neighborhoods or turn people in when they commit crimes. And pretty soon you're just going to have a complete erosion of that trust between the community and law enforcement. So the question you're asking specifically is could California do this? Yeah, they could pass an initiative. They could pass a law. There's active consideration of doing that. Would it hold up to a federal challenge? Is you know, I think it very well could. Am I missing some part of your question?
The essential question is, can a bill or California ballot initiative be introduced to assert states' rights? So we have state sovereignty. So
yeah.
As a constituent,
so, yeah, I understand.
Introduce one?
As to our government, yes. We could do that. Could we, by legislation in this state, prevent ICE from operating here? No, we can't do that. So that's sort of the nuanced line between those two considerations.
We can do state rights to deny jurisdiction of ICE in such a way that state and local enforcement agencies, as well as civilian organizations and individuals, be prohibited to
cooperate.
Yeah,
this may seem like a nuance, but I think your question may be conflating a couple things. We can absolutely prevent our local jurisdictions from doing the immigration enforcement thing. That part, yes. We cannot prevent the federal folks from coming into California and doing it. So I hope that makes sense and answers your question. Yeah, let's go over here. Thank you.
Hi. My first town hall meeting.
All right.
Very happy to be here.
What's your name?
Lorraine Thorpe.
Lorraine, thanks for being here.
My question is that with the current investigations into the Russian connection of the Trump campaign, that at some point the findings would be referred to the Department of Justice. And is there any congressional pressure that could be put on Jeff Sessions to recuse himself since he was an active member of the Trump campaign?
Right.
And along with congressional pressure, is there any pressure that can be put on Donald Trump to disclose his taxes? And possibly in the future, a bill be introduced that would require presidents to disclose their taxes?
Yeah. Well, those are terrific questions. So let's start with Jeff Sessions and this terrible situation we have, maybe even a constitutional crisis, where he seems to have the final say on whether an investigation leads to action. And many people, including some Republican senators, believe that under existing law, he must recuse himself. That by law, he's required to recuse himself. However, in his confirmation hearings, he bobbed and weaved on this, and he refused to really answer the question. Still got himself narrowly confirmed. So we don't know whether Jeff Sessions would do the right thing. We know that if he doesn't, there's going to be a lawsuit, and it would appear as a matter of statutory law that he would be in violation if he didn't recuse himself. If he does recuse himself, then the next person down in the Department of Justice, I believe, is the U.S. Attorney in Maryland, who people in both parties have a lot of confidence in. It is a very, you know, person of honor and integrity, and would carry out his duties wherever the facts may lead. I don't have that kind of confidence in Jeff Sessions. I'll be very honest with you. So let's see where it goes. Let's certainly not accept whatever he may say if that moment comes. And let's support groups that are lawyered up and ready to take on this challenge. Right? Yeah. And the next part of your question, remind me. Trump's taxes, yeah. So you asked, could a law be passed to mandate disclosure of tax returns? You know, politically, it's possible. I don't know, you know, whether that could stand constitutional challenge or not. There's probably a reason why in the past it's just always been done voluntarily. It's been just a norm and an expectation that everybody accepted. I'm going to run for president. I need to share with the American people this kind of information. And for the first time in 40 years, we have someone who's unwilling to do that, despite having promised to do that. So I'll certainly look into whether there's something we can do to change the law. Probably right now, people are going to provide cover for Trump in the Republican Congress. They're going to want to, it'll be tough for that law to make progress. But let's remember this moment and this issue so that in the future, when the political opportunity to enact something like that comes along, maybe we can do it for the next person and the next Donald Trump. I know there's talk here in California. My colleague Mike McGuire, your state senator, has an interesting bill that would require disclosure of the tax return in order to get on the California state ballot for president. So, I love that concept. I mean, it sounds great. I'm gonna cheer him on. I'm a little worried whether that can actually, you know, sustain constitutional muster, to tell you the truth. But thanks for the question. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My name's Mary from Eureka. I'm local, not being paid. I'm local, if anyone knows kinetic sculpture stuff. I guess I'd like to say I've been on Twitter for 10 years now, and I think it's really an important tool that people need to learn. Even if you're old, ask a friend. You need to learn because it's a good organizing tool, and I don't think the Democrats are using it to full advantage. I wanted to ask, I'm very scared. You hear Trump throwing out nuclear.
Yeah.
if I said it right. But I don't think he's mentally fit to be president. He isn't. When can like the 25th Amendment mm-hmm. or Logan Act take right. him down? I mean, before his little fingers get...
Yeah. So you're a fan of Twitter, but you're also horrified at what he does on Twitter. It sounds like, okay. Yeah, yeah. So you asked about the 25th Amendment and the Logan Act. So let's take those in order. 25th Amendment is one of these sort of never events that you don't even like to think about. A president of the United States who is mentally ill or otherwise incapacitated to the degree that they need to be removed from office, and it does provide a mechanism for that to happen. It requires the vice president and a whole bunch of other officials that are set forth specifically in the 25th Amendment to come to Congress and present a document that would temporarily make the vice president the president. So if that were to happen at some point, you'd have temporary President Pence, and then there's a period of time under which President Trump would be able to come back with his own declaration and say, no, I am competent, and here's a majority of cabinet officials and other specified folks that agree with me, I should be reinstated. So it goes back and forth, and then the vice president can do it again, and if the vice president does it again, it's final, and the president is removed from office. It's never happened. I think it's far more likely through emolument clause issues, conflicts of interest, crazy irrational behavior, weird revelations about Russia, take your pick, that serious investigations of all that could actually build to the point where you might see an impeachment that could remove President Trump. But I think it's pretty unlikely that the 25th Amendment does the trick. Now, the Logan Act is even more unlikely to help us out here. This is a law that goes all the way back to 1799. I tried to use the Logan Act. I tried to actually get the outgoing attorney general to create a special counsel to prosecute, to investigate and prosecute the Trump campaign. The Logan Act says that private citizens can't conduct foreign policy to the detriment of their government, basically. And we know that they did this. We know, I mentioned earlier, our intelligence community has concluded there were constant contacts between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence officials. We know that Donald Trump got in and really muddied the waters on the One China policy with Taiwan. We know that at the very time the Obama administration was rolling out new sanctions against Russia for its cyber crimes, that Trump, through General Flynn, was telling them to just ignore them. We'll take them away when we come into office. These are prima facie violations of the Logan Act. The problem is a lot of people think the Logan Act is not very constitutional itself. So it just is not something I was able to get the prior attorney general to take seriously. And as much as it comes up on cable shows and other things all the time, I don't see a lot of prosecutors really creating much energy around Logan Act investigations or prosecutions, I'm sorry to say. Yeah. Whistleblowers are promising, too. That's right. We're going to really need people of conscience who have decided to stay in their government jobs under this administration, scientists and others who will help tell the story. Yeah, let's go over here.
Thank you, Representative Hussman, for being here today. My name is Dylan Scott. I am uneasy. I am a bit flabbergasted, and I am rather angered at Washington's bullish approach to rescind environmental protections. So I have two questions for you. The first is, amidst such egregious legislation like House Resolution 861, which was introduced by Representative Matt Geyes of Florida, it essentially abolishes the EPA, all right? Yeah. And then the second that was just recently passed, which is the House Joint Resolution 38, introduced by Bill Johnson of Ohio, which abolished the Department of Interior's streamlined protection rule, mm-hmm. which you voted against, and I thank you for that. My question is, what are you currently doing, and what do you plan to do in the future to improve legal protections for the environment and also pursue a paradigm of environmental justice as you serve as a vice-ranking member of our Natural Resource Committee?
Great. Great questions. Thank you. So you mentioned one bill, the one to eliminate the EPA, that I think we probably have a pretty good chance of stopping. In this climate, you do need to worry about even overreaching things like that, because it's possible if they got to Trump's desk, they might be able to pass something like that. But they've got to get through the Senate. They could pass that through the House, I hate to tell you. I think a bill to eliminate the EPA would sail through the House on party lines, and that's how bad it is. But things are a little different in the U.S. Senate because you would need 60 votes to end debate and bring that to the floor. And I think we've got enough of a firewall that we can hold against legislation like that. But the first one you referenced, the stream buffer, stream protection rule, it's on its way to the president's desk. It has passed. And we're seeing so many things like that. It's only been a couple of months of this new Congress and this new administration, and it is just a wrecking ball on our environment. So we've got to be mobilized. We're going to have to challenge this in Congress. I'm on the front line of that. I'll do everything I can to fight the early stage of that fight as these things come through. Our United States senators are critically important. We've got to hold enough Democrats to prevent a cloture vote that would allow this stuff to go to the floor. We've got to have just everybody's voice in this country speaking up loud and clear to create backlash so that they know this is not okay. And then the last thing you asked, what we're going to do specifically about it, we're going to have to go to court on a lot of these things. We're going to have to take them to court. And I'll just add one more thing that should be part of this resistance to these environmental rollbacks. We got to continue to lead and lean forward at the state and local government level, because there's nothing about what they're doing that prevents the state of California from continuing to fight for clean water and clean air and climate leadership and wildlife protection and all the things we care about. Okay? So let's do it.
Okay. And then my second question was, do you believe that the environment, trees have legal standing?
The trees have legal standing? Well, I think maybe not trees as such, but through the public trust doctrine, all of us on behalf of the trees, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hi there. My name is Desiree, and mm-hmm. I live in Eureka, and I'm an environmentalist as well, so
right.
It's a little repetitive maybe, but my main concern is climate change, especially living in a coastal town. And I want to know if the Democratic Party is going to treat climate change as the emergency that it is and make it a global effort and keep us in the Paris Agreement
yeah.
and
Good.
Keep our EPA and all these things.
All
I
right.
appreciate what you said about the EPA.
Well, great. Thank you. Thanks for your question. And thanks to you and everyone else here that gets it and cares about these things. I think I can say with confidence that the answer is yes. I'm actually very encouraged that at least on the Democratic side of the aisle in Congress, there's incredible support for climate leadership. I introduced a bill in the last Congress called the Keep It in the Ground Act that is a pretty bold step. I did this working with a couple of leading groups, Sierra Club, 350.org, and others, because it recognizes that the science tells us we've got to keep 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves in the ground if we're going to limit climate change to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius. And we are not on a trajectory to do that, and so this bill shuts down fossil fuel extraction from our public lands and off our shores. That's a pretty bold step, and you know what? I think north of 40 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives among my Democratic colleagues. I don't think you would have seen that a few years back. So I really do think politically within Congress we have more support than we have had in the past. And I think beyond that, the American people are ready. Every poll indicates that even among independents, Republicans, there is a desire to do something about climate change. People are worried about the impacts, and they think they're increasingly beginning to see that there's an upside to showing climate leadership, that we can actually be the leaders on clean energy and maybe create some jobs and speak to some of the economic dislocation in this country. But the other piece of it, and you alluded to this in your question, is the Paris Agreement and continuing to go forward with the progress that we've made. Look, 190 countries came to Paris with specific commitments, not just an acknowledgement of climate change, but actually their own commitments to doing something about it, and a commitment to keep coming back regularly to ratchet those levels up to further reduce greenhouse gases. In addition to those countries, there was an enormous participation at what we call the subnational level, nonprofit organizations, the faith community, corporate citizens. We had 80 major companies that went to Paris with commitments to use their supply chains and their purchasing and things like that to actually do their part. Just because Trump is a climate denier and has put Scott Pruitt in charge of the EPA doesn't change any of that. All of that should continue to move forward. And hopefully the rest of the world won't have to move forward temporarily without our federal government. Even if they do, though, they're going to keep moving forward with the United States of America. It'll just be our corporate citizens, our local governments, our faith community, our nonprofits. The U.S. will be at the table, and we're going to keep moving forward on climate leadership.
Congressman Huffman, Vivian Hellowell, Pacific Coast Vivian. Federation of Fishermen's Associations.
Great to see you.
First, thank you for being a champion for the salmon and the fishermen.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a two-part question for you that deals with this year's flooding and the dire salmon situation in this area. First, we're wondering if the dam safety and disaster relief money that comes through this area, if part of it can be help deal with the root causes of these serious issues for people and for salmon. For example, can we make sure that fish passage, habitat improvements, such as floodplain enhancement and sediment mitigation, can be prioritized along with fixing our road system? Our roads and hillsides are sure to fail again due to historic logging and poor road structure, and flooding is predicted to get worse due to climate change. We have a local example of citizens who can't get in and out their road from flooding and their and Elk River when it rains 2 inches and their properties are being buried under mud that are coming down off the mountains. The second part of the question, as for dam and levee safety, we're very concerned with dam safety issues at the Lewiston Dam on Trinity River and wonder what other dams that impact Humboldt County have similar issues to Oroville. Is there an assessment of the North Coast dam safety? When can we deal with dam safety and improvement issues that will prioritize fish passage and floodplain enhancement?
All right. Vivian, thanks. Thank you for your dam question. I appreciate it. Yeah. So as far as whether federal disaster relief can be made available for some of the ecological improvements that you very rightly point out that we need to include, I don't know. I'll take a look and I'll check. I know at the state level we have some pretty darn good policies that require Caltrans to start replacing culverts that impede fish passage, and sometimes they just exist on the books and not in the real world, so we got to push to always get it enforced. But I will certainly be happy to look into putting any federal dollars that come our way into smart reparations that are good for fish passage and floodplain restoration. On the issue of dam safety, obviously the Oroville Dam was a huge wake-up call to all of us, and you're absolutely right that Trinity Dam does not have an emergency spillway. It wasn't designed quite the same way as Oroville Dam was. But here's what I want to say in response to your question about can we have confidence in the safety of dams and, you know, what are we doing about it. For the past several years in Washington, anybody that's followed my work on water, and I am the ranking member on the Key Water Subcommittee there, we've just been having the wrong conversation. If you had asked anyone in Washington, you know, what's the big thing with California water, they'd say, well, it's the fight between fish and farmers. And it's about, you know, whether you care more about the 2-inch delta smelt or the breadbasket of the world in the San Joaquin Valley. Completely false choice, a complete distraction from the real conversation that we need to have. And so last year was a great example. This huge fight took place. And at the end of the year, House Republicans, Kevin McCarthy and others, actually teamed up, to my great disappointment, with our senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, and they attached a rider to a really important water infrastructure bill, and it took away some Endangered Species Act protections in the Delta. And we fought that. We lost. At the end of the day, even though they said, we've got to do this to capture flows this winter, and you know we've been suffering from the drought, they haven't gotten any additional water from these rollbacks of ESA protections in the Delta, not one drop. What they have done is they've taken a little bite out of the Endangered Species Act, and they've set a precedent that we now know will be used. Every time there's a controversial listing around the country, people are going to say, well, in this case, Congress overrode the scientists and kind of rewrote the biological opinion. It was terrible, terrible public policy, and it's mainly, more important, it's the wrong conversation. We should be talking about Oroville Dam, and we should be talking about the neglected infrastructure we see all over this state. That conversation is not yet happening. We've still got folks back in Washington that think somehow magically billions of dollars are going to appear for new dams that they would like, that hardly anyone would benefit from, that can't really pencil out on their own. I think that's kind of a fantasy discussion. But if we can change the conversation, and maybe Oroville will help us change the conversation back to something really important and here and now that we have to do throughout the state, and that is make sure every dam is structurally in good shape. If it needs to be better maintained or modernized or whatever, that's where we need to spend our limited dollars right now as our first priority, rather than these crazy pipe dreams of new dams in the Central Valley. Right? No, I'm the Twin Tunnels, right. Pipe dream, literally. Okay. Yeah.
So we need to get you on the road, but if you're okay, can we real fast try to get to, through
Let's
the
Let's try to get everybody who's already in line. My apologies to anybody who was going to get in line, but I do have about a five-hour drive before I sleep tonight, so I'd better draw the line there. Thank you. Let's go.
I'll try and make this fast. Congressman Huffman, it's nice as a U.S. citizen to know that someone from the government is here to listen to everyone.
Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you. With over 40% of the Great Barrier Reef suffering coral bleaching and massive ice shelves breaking, right. It's evident that there is significant warming across the globe. With a virtually unanimous scientific consensus that climate change is happening, there seems to be a lot of people who are either denying climate change or are doing nothing to contribute to mitigating climate change. My question is, how are you in California working to further scientific literacy amongst people and working to combat misinformation?
It's a great question. I will share with you one piece of an answer to it. Just this week, I was one of the original lead co-sponsors of a resolution we introduce every year called the Darwin Resolution that actually acknowledges the importance of science. And it goes a little further this year and talks about the imperative scientifically, economically, morally, of doing some of the things you're referencing on climate change. I'm doing a lot more than that. We're fighting in the trenches in every way by trying to promote clean energy, by trying to stop dirty fossil fuel energy, by opposing projects like Keystone and like the Dakota Access Pipeline. And, you know, we're taking a little bit of a step back now in the early days of this administration, but I think we're on the right side of history, and I appreciate your question very much. Support those scientists, by the way, who are marching and protesting. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you very much for being here, and my condolences to your family for your loss. My question, first of all, I'm Alan McCloskey. I'm one of the Assembly District Delegates for the Democratic
great.
Central Committee.
Congratulations.
I'm also a Bernocrat and a proud all member right. of the North Coast Good. People's Alliance.
Good.
So having said all that, our county, Humboldt County here, voted for Bernie Sanders in excess of 70%. And I think that says a lot about the political composition of our county. So I do have some reservations about the direction that you chose to go, which was contrary
sure.
to our support for Bernie, so I'd like some justification from you on that.
Okay.
The second part of my question would be, in a local context, going forward, knowing the political composition of Humboldt County to be as progressive as it is, I don't want to see you as our congressman, you know, in this next year. I'm thinking about the Board of Supervisors for Humboldt County. I don't want it to come out that you've done something crazy like endorse Rex Bone. That would be contrary to our progressive values, I believe.
We can speak to that, too. Go right ahead.
I think I've said enough, maybe too much.
Nah, hey, it's all fair game. So let's start with the fact that I was a superdelegate. That's sort of the way it works when you get elected to the Congress. This is my first time around as a superdelegate. And if I had a redo on that, I'd certainly handle it a little bit differently. But where I ultimately came out was to say that I would vote for the person who won the most, who clinched the nomination, basically, is what I said. I would go to the convention and support whoever had clinched the most earned delegates at the polls. I didn't think superdelegates should be deciding this election. They never have, and I didn't want them to this time. Now, that I realize, and I get it, that wasn't good enough for some people, that some people wanted me to go to the convention in Philadelphia, and even though Hillary had overwhelmingly secured enough earned pledge delegates for the nomination, they wanted me to vote the way my district came out for Bernie anyway, even though Bernie did not want that. Okay? Let's remember that. So I guess, you know, with all due respect, I'm really delighted by the movement that expressed itself in this election in my district. I think it speaks to the values of my district, the politics of my district. I was thrilled that at that convention, Bernie Sanders and his team were full partners at the table writing the most progressive Democratic platform in history. And I was really proud to see the coming together that we saw in Philadelphia. I was proud to see Bernie out there campaigning, and ultimately Bernie and Hillary were on the same team. I'm proud that today, right now, Bernie Sanders, even though he's not a Democrat, is one of the leading voices in the Democratic Party. That's a little strange, all right, but, you know, I'm totally good with it. So, I went to the convention and I did what Bernie did. I supported the person who had clinched the vote. I thought we needed to come together. I thought this was really important for the fall. And that's just where it was, okay? Second part of your question was local endorsements. So, you know, let me speak to that. You know, the smart thing for someone in my position to do would just never endorse locally because there's usually no good that comes from it. I've certainly gotten more grief than benefit from wading into local contests, but every now and then, when there's a local official that I work with on things, whatever their politics are, I think party lines, when you get down to local government, just matter an awful lot less, in my opinion, but it doesn't mean values and votes and records and policies don't matter, and I understand that, you know, you've got some obvious differences with a few folks in local office. I get that. Get out there and get candidates to run for office that are good, viable candidates. And, you know, my advice, when you get into a situation where an incumbent is running without any opposition or without any credible opposition, sitting around complaining about the endorsements they get doesn't fix anything. Go put someone viable up against them and make it hard for anyone to endorse them. Okay? That's the answer. And there sometimes is a complacency about that, if we're going to be very honest. It's hard to build that capacity and to build that bench. But that's the work that has to happen. If you think someone is wrong on the policy, wrong on their votes, you got to come up with an opponent and do the hard work and build the capacity to beat them. That's, you know, yeah.
Right. So this is our last one on this side.
Okay.
Can you look over, please? I can't talk with you in my face.
Excuse me, sir.
I can't talk with her right in my face.
But please, be respectful of my staff.
I'm trying to, but she didn't.
Ask your question, sir.
I want to know what you're doing about the application which is a danger to California infrastructure that AT&T has in to, by the year 2020 to take away all the landlines and force us all onto cell phones. It's a pretty important issue to me.
Good.
I have problems speaking with someone right in front of me. I wasn't trying to be rude.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate your passion, but please respect. Hand the microphone back to my staffer. That's how we're doing it. Yeah. Thanks. Look, I'm going to answer your question, and I do appreciate your passion. A lot of people feel like they're going to be stranded by the abandonment of copper wire. And so it's a very appropriate and valid question. I can tell you that the state PUC is ultimately probably going to be where that gets decided. And we all know that the telecoms want to move to voice over internet technology because that's how their other content is delivered. It's much more efficient for them to move to the same fiber or to move to wireless and other things. So, look, I think we've got to support legacy copper lines for as long as people are using them and as long as they're dependent on them. And I hope so. I certainly, when I was in the state legislature, I supported that every time I had a chance to do it. But, well, sure, I will. But honestly, you need to be talking to your state legislators about this and to folks at the state PUC. But I do understand. I don't want to see people stranded that have copper lines. And I get it. I get it. These lines are being neglected. They're failing. Yeah. It is a lifeline. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. I think we've got two more on this side, and that's it. We'll call it.
Thank you. Hello, Representative Hoffman. My name is Kelsey, and I'm the co-coordinator of the Humboldt Move to Amend group.
Great.
So first off, I just wanted to thank you for co-sponsoring HJR 48, which established that money is not free speech and that human rights are only for human beings and not corporations. So thank you for that. So knowing that Mike Thompson has also pledged to amend, will you help us get him to follow through with that pledge by officially co-sponsoring HJR 48? And then my second question was, who do you know that also might be interested that you could help us get to co-sponsor?
Okay. So you're asking me to round up more co-sponsors for this resolution that I'm already supporting? I will do what I can, you know. I'll bring it up the next time we have a delegation lunch, and I want to see as many co-sponsors as possible, too. So we'll keep working. Yeah. Thanks for being part of that. Yeah. And I think this gentleman has the final word, so this is it. Yeah.
Congressman Hoffman, thank you for showing up here in the North Coast.
It's good to be with you.
Our last congressman, the reason why I put a check in your box is because you do come up here.
Thank you.
And
thank
this
you.
Is our community.
Thank you.
My name is Brian Fallon. I'm a veteran. Served
Thanks for
proudly.
Your service.
Thank you. I'm here asking you, sir, to roll up your sleeves and help us veterans here on the North Coast. We do have a facility in Eureka. Thank you. We do have a facility in Eureka.
Yeah.
We have no primary
no
care doctors,
yep.
sir. I did get hurt. I fell. I walked around for a month in pain with five ligaments torn off my shoulder. Wow. Here on the North Coast, I didn't get no help. I'm not saying the VA is horrible.
Right.
They have a lot of great things going on in there. They help me. My therapy's great.
Right.
My eyeglasses are
great.
We have no primary doctors.
Yeah.
When a person gets hurt, we need a doctor. Sir,
it's a big problem.
The reason we've been told is they won't come here because they take a cut in pay to come to the North Coast. That's wrong. Us veterans need doctors, and we need good doctors. Why can you help us try and correct this problem?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. It really is a tragedy that we have a VA clinic here that has gone through. This has been a problem for a long time. I mean, I toured the clinic a couple years ago, and they weren't totally out of providers, but they were getting pretty close. It's a great, wonderful, shiny new clinic, state-of-the-art. It's got everything you need except doctors, right? And
what they're doing is they're sending doctors here for 6 months.
Right,
and
yeah.
These we're not getting the services because.
So you're right.
And we have to
they're
look at
loaning
a screen
places
now.
From other. Yeah.
We have to look at a screen now and talk to a doctor out of San Francisco.
Right.
It's not personal no more.
I hear you. And look, I want to do everything I can. You're right. The economics are part of it. It's been this is not just the VA, folks. This is something that if you talk to St. Joe's or if you talk to the Open Door Clinic or you talk to the Indian Health Service, it's really, really hard to recruit and retain healthcare providers up here in a spectacular place to live. We've sort of got to get the word out on that part. Yep. But it has been tough. So the compensation formula needs to be adjusted. And I'm going to do what I can to try to fight to change that, to create more incentives to bring people here. But I'm trying to do one other thing, too, that I think might help. I'm about to introduce, in fact, I actually think I introduced it last week, a really big national service bill. We're calling it our 21st Century National Service Bill, that would really look at what we need to do to support service across the board, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, all the different programs that can help people along their professional path, but also just do an awful lot of good in underserved places. And helping physicians who choose to work in places like Humboldt and Del Norte and Trinity and Mendocino counties by giving them loan forgiveness, for example, or other incentives on their student debt would go a long way. Yeah. And then, you know, there's a lot of good ideas out there, again, because everybody's in the same boat. It's the hospital, it's the health clinic, it's everyone, the VA. You know, there's got to be some innovation up here, and it is happening. So the Open Door Clinic is actually looking at a program to provide funding for grandparents so that, you know, couples can come here, and by the time you get my age, if you're a physician, you know, you're caring for elderly parents a lot of the time, and people worry, will they be able to do that up here, and can they manage that extra cost? And so they're actually providing some additional compensation in the form of parental care and assistance. And we're going to need to be creative. We're going to need to all work together, and I'm going to need to try to get some of those formulas changed in Washington, but I totally want to fix this problem, and I thank you for the question. Right? All right. Well, folks, this has been a great conversation. Thank you. Thank you for caring enough about your country and your community to get up and come to a town hall. I'm going to go back to Washington, and I'm going to tell my Republican colleagues, what are you so afraid of? These town hall meetings are great. You got to do them. So thank you. This has been a great conversation, and it won't be the last conversation. We'll have more of them. It's a great honor to serve you. Thank you.